Hey guys, this is Colin back with the Busby Babe podcast, and I'm joined by Nathan Heinchel. And Nathan, I know things aren't going great at Manchester United right now, but how are you doing today?
Actually kind of a weird day for me all around. As some of you might know, I'm a manager of digital content and communications for the Richmond Kickers, which is a third division side here in America. And unfortunately, we had to, the club announced that we had let our head coach go today. They did not renew his contract. So all around weird day, between the Colleen Rooney stuff, Manchester United in general, and then that, it's been an odd soccer week.
Yeah. yeah, this Colleen Rooney stuff broke this morning. So we're recording on the day that it all happened and the Twitter meltdown. I mean, it was so big that people in group me's that I'm in that are not related to soccer at all were talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a seismic shift in, I think, the culture as far as, you know, soccer Twitter spilling over. You know how you have these moments sometimes like NBA Twitter spills over into kind of the more mainstream. This was soccer's moment to really kind of get out there and grab people who are just interested in the salacious content, not necessarily the football content. And this checked all the boxes, I think.
Yeah, and it was really cool to see, I guess, this just giant non-soccer community stand up and say, you know, we stand when it comes to Colleen Rooney. I mean, hell of a detective, apparently.
I'll tell you what, if you guys aren't following our editor-in-chief, Brent Maximin, please give him a follow on Twitter. He was on fire this morning. It really just perked me up. That's exactly what I needed.
Yeah, he's very good at Twitter just in general, but yeah, today especially.
Yeah, dreary Wednesday, Brent Maximin came with the fire tweets. You know, shout-outs to him.
All right, so going into the unfortunate Manchester United talk. Fresh off a 1-0 defeat at St. James's Park to Newcastle. Before that, the 1-1 draw against Arsenal in one of the worst games I've ever watched between top six sides in England. Well, quote, top six sides in England. And then before that, the West Ham loss and a very boring, equally boring draw to AZ Alkmaar. Manchester United have not scored more than one goal in the game since the 4-0 win over Chelsea at Old Trafford on opening day. What do you think are some of the contributing factors to this, Nathan? Because it's not just the injuries, because, I mean, you know, we've still got Marcus Rashford in the squad. Paul Pogba played in a couple of the games. And I don't know if it's, I mean, people say the defense is leaking, but that hasn't really been the case either, because we've only conceded about one goal in every match as well since Crystal Palace.
I mean, I think the main contributing factor at this point is the midfield in general. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where our defense is set up to play well, but they don't have a buffer zone between them. And then I guess maybe on a good day, our attack should be there. We certainly saw it against Chelsea. They are capable of scoring goals. But once again, if you don't have that buffer zone in between the attack and the defense, a lot of things are going to break down. And it's very clear right now that the spine of Manchester United is just broken, whether it be injuries, lack of quality, potentially even, you know, game plan deficiencies. It's been a huge issue, I think, and that's been probably one of the main contributing factors. It was something that we yelled and screamed about, you know, in the offseason, and it didn't get addressed. And right now, you know, watching those last three matches that you just talked about, I think Bruno Fernandes would be better than Fred, right? I mean, that was the big knock on Bruno Fernandes, was he gave the ball away too much. I don't know what I just saw Fred do, but I think Bruno would do a better job.
Yeah, and he'll at least, you know, attempt a forward pass.
Yeah, or when he does attempt a forward pass, I don't know, it might make it to somebody that's in a red shirt.
Right. I know Marcus Rashford's out of form, but I'd say part of that is not on him because of the distribution he's getting. You know, Pogba's been in and out with, you know, a lingering injury. But when he is in the squad, I mean, we saw it against Arsenal, he'll put the ball in front of Rashford to run onto at least one or two times a game. But he will make sure that the strikers have some opportunities to score. And
yeah, and that was the combo that, you know, we saw when Ollie went on his first run, was you'd have Paul Pogba just dropping these, you know, dimes just 40, 50 yards down the field, and Rashford was right there, nipping at the backfield line, ready to make his run. The moment that ball was in the air, he was pushing the center backs, and he was usually leaving it on his, you know, his landing right on his right foot where he wanted it. Whether he finished it was a different story, but, you know, he was getting the ball placement that he wanted.
Yeah, and that's the thing about scoring a lot of goals is you have to take a lot of chances. I mean, people will point to some of the problems Lukaku had with scoring goals, and yet there were a lot of problems with his first touch. But if you look at the opportunities that, you know, Harry Kane and Sergio Aguero get, they're getting, you know, double-digit chances each game. And that's why they're scoring 20 to 30 goals each season. And maybe Tony Martial coming back will help a little bit with Marcus Rashford kind of establishing a connection with other attackers. But this midfield of, you know, Mata, McTominay, Fred is not going to work, or Andres Pereira, Jesse Lingard in behind. There's just no creativity and no structure.
Yeah, and I think that's been that's just the biggest issue right now. They're just not, no one up top is getting the service that, you know, would be deemed something that you could set a play up from. I mean, we've got Dan James who can cut the ball inside or deliver a cross. And of course, then at the other end of that, you then see that there's nobody on the backside of the cross. And so they're not taking advantage of that either. But just right now, we watched Manchester United bench Scott McTominay because they needed him for the league match and they didn't want to overwork him from Arsenal to Alkmaar, because right now he's our best midfielder, which somewhere, you know, Jose Mourinho is just smiling ear to ear. I got a lot of love for Scott McTominay as well, but we wrote about it here at the Busby Babe. If he's our best midfielder, then that's indicative of a much, much bigger problem right now.
Yeah, and that's not a dig at Scott McTominay either. That's just a dig at the recruitment strategy, because Scott McTominay is a fine midfielder, but there's an enormous gap in quality between him and Paul Pogba. And when he's Paul Pogba's partner, you know, I mean, that's obviously a better midfield than if his midfield partner was Nemanja Matic or Fred, but there's still a lack of quality and a lack of structure there and maybe it's not even that midfield too that's the problem, but it's that number 10 role. And I think maybe if Pogba was up there and somebody else was alongside McTominay, it might be working out a little bit better. But there's just not options for Ole to work out with.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to sound like I'm besmirching Scott McTominay either. I just think it's a lot of pressure this is something that we see throughout the entire squad. That's a lot of pressure that we're heaping on a really young player. It's like, hey, I need you to go be the guy right now. Paul Pogba's out. Like, you're our best midfielder. And Scott McTominay is sitting there going, like, a word? And so I really think he's stepping up and he's doing what he's supposed to, but he just doesn't have any help. And then he gets exposed because a guy like a Fred, you know, can't make a forward pass, or Nemanja Matic is just a statue in the midfield. He doesn't have a partner in the midfield. That was the big knock that we had on, you know, Lindelof played really well last year, but he didn't have a partner in the central part of the defense. We get Harry Maguire, all of a sudden, you know, they were looking pretty good. Lindelof's a little shaky right now, but at least right now it feels like that is at least patched over. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, you know, who's going to be Pogba's partner in the midfield? I personally don't have an issue if it would be at that double pivot of like a Pogba and a McTominay in the 4-2-3-1. But the problem is we don't have that number 10, not somebody that's going to be as creative. Like, Juan Mata is a fine player. He can serve up the ball. He brings a different element. But I think to the main way that Ole wants to play, Mata's not the right guy for that. He's better, more of a sub to bring in a different look, not somebody that's going to run 3/4 of your game for you at the 10. And so once again, we run into these things like, you know, maybe Bruno Fernandes would have been really good in this role, or... But I digress.
Yeah. And we are going to talk about the January window and maybe some potential targets that we see as quick fixes for some of the problems in midfield. But I want to kind of pivot to this Ole out talk on Twitter, because we haven't really seen it from the fans that are actually at the games. They've largely been, you know, still singing his name and then singing Glazers out or Woodward out. So do you think that maybe that's just people on Twitter being people on Twitter, or do you think that there's, because there's some truth to this, that Ole is maybe not working out, but there's definitely also an argument to be made in his favor that he's not being, you know, trusted with us or been given a squad that he can trust.
I think a lot of that movement is chalked up to kind of that Twitter mob mentality. You get a lot of people who get on there, me included. I enjoy a good retweet or a like here and there, but I think a lot of people are jumping on that, just trying to be the first person to be the one who's like, I told you we should have got rid of Ollie. But you see it right there in the stand. He's still getting clapped off of the field. And it's, I don't feel like it's certainly in a mocking way either. Like maybe Mourinho would have got it at the very end. I think there's still a lot of love inside Old Trafford for Ollie. I think there's still a lot of love out on Twitter too. It's just one of those things where last thing you want to do too is proclaim your love for Ollie on Twitter and then have the mob come after you as well. I think right now, certainly Ollie does look like he's a little bit out of his depth, as a lot of people have said. I think that's probably correct. I think he's still capable of, you know, if he had the right players in place, I think he's capable of implementing his system. I think for the most part, he's a pretty good man manager. The one nice thing that you're not hearing is problems in the dressing room about, you know, the snakes coming out against the manager. I think for the most part, he's well loved in that dressing room. It's just when he was a relatively green manager, throwing him with a bare bones roster was going to be a recipe for disaster. So I think that's what's brewing a lot of that Ollie out conversation. Whether or not it's actually going to take place, I'm caught in between thinking that, you know, the leadership of the club sees Ollie kind of as a scapegoat. So once again, you know, deflect attention off of the fact that the club is now officially posting lower revenues. It's stagnating in a lot of key areas. There's a great TIFO football video about the finances of Manchester United that just came out, I think, 2 days ago or a day ago, talking about how they're starting to link lack of on-field success to lack of financial success. And so, you know, they want to have Ollie almost as that poster child as they try and do this rebuild as a sacrificial lamb. I think if the wrong result were to happen, I think he could be fired, just because it's the same reason why they had to hire him. They would have to fire him. But, you know, right now I think his job is safe simply just because he's deflecting a lot of attention on Twitter away from, you know, Ed Woodward and the Glazers.
Yeah, and, you know, if we were actually, like, in a relegation battle, you know, further along in the season, then maybe this conversation can be legitimized by that. But I would still much rather trust him with this squad than fire a manager, you know, half a year into a supposed 3-year rebuild. It's just not something that this club can afford to do. And I think the fact that Ed Woodward is still making the Glazers money is definitely the reason he still has a job, but that would be his fourth manager he's fired in 6 years. I mean, it's getting ridiculous.
Well, you would have that expectation in a normalized situation that if, you know, you're responsible as a manager, if you're responsible and the people under you, if you have that level of turnover, eventually your boss starts to wonder what's the problem. I mean, that works in all facets of business. It's not just football. You know, it works at Best Buy. It works, you know, at Target. Like, if you're a manager and the people under you aren't performing, eventually that's going to come back on you because you're the reason why these people are in place. You know, it's your decisions. You need to be accountable for them. Now, I use the term normalization because I don't think this is a normalized situation right now. The Glazers, I think, are just fine using Manchester United as a bank account. And so whatever continues to keep the coffers deep is cool with them. I mean, clearly they don't care. You can base that on their other sporting franchise, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who are continuously mired in mediocrity. They don't, I mean, as long as the budget balances and they're not losing money, I don't think they honestly care about team performance. It would be a nice plus, but I don't think that's their main concern.
Yeah, and it is weird for them too. It must be that because they didn't invest money really into the team when Sir Alex was manager. They just kind of, you know, trusted that he could win with them, and of course he could because he's the GOAT. But now we're really seeing the problems that are in place in actual football knowledge in the management of this club, because there is none left, really. I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson was kind of like a Bill Belichick, where he could recruit his own players. And now they're trying to establish the structure of Ed Woodward. Managers are having to trust Ed Woodward to buy the players that they need. And kind of I guess pivoting this conversation more towards January, even if there is money available in January, I'm not sure I trust Ed Woodward to actually recruit and secure deals in a month.
No, that's way too short of a time for Ed Woodward. We know this. It requires an entire summer to lock down Harry Maguire because I guess they were – I think the reports were that they were complaining over maybe like squabbling over £5 million, which if you're stuck between 75 and 80, Ed, at that point, just pay the money. Like, right. You know you need the position, and this is obviously the guy you want that you've even taken the conversation that far.
And if we're actually in a position where the Glazers will protest to him over £5 million in a transfer – then we really are in more trouble than we even recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Real Madrid is still a work in progress right now, but they recognize what positions they need to fix, and they drop stacks. Mm-hmm. And at least they won the offseason because people were like, oh, wow, look at them. You know, they were mired in, you know, weirdness last year, and they went and just fixed all their problems with the stroke of a couple pens, and they got it done, and they got it done where all the players were in and they were doing preseason, which is also not something that Manchester United is capable of. I'm certainly not hopeful for the January window right now because I don't think that that's really the time or place to be doing the kind of recruitment that the team was angling for in the summer. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not really a prime time for you to go get a Daniel James. In January, you're in the middle of the season and you're looking for solutions to just finish your season and either stop the bleeding, get that last piece you need to win, you know, whatever your situation is. So I couldn't imagine that they'd go after like a Bruno Fernandes or an Erling Haaland. You know, it would be like a Mario Mandzukic. Like, we just need someone that'll score us 10 goals between January and May and save us from whatever situation we're in.
Yeah. But I think it is worth pointing out that, you know, United's often being compared to Liverpool in the 90s and 2000s for their fall from grace after being the most dominant club, not only in England, but at times in Europe. But I mean, they bought Virgil van Dijk in January and it totally transformed their season. So I know that January is a weird time to buy players because you don't have a lot of time and you're bringing someone in mid season to try and change your team, but it is possible for something to totally change this team.
I think the difference with the Liverpool comparison, though, is they were ready. I mean, they were right there.
They had that front three already in place, the Sadio Mane, Salah, Roberto Firmino. And
yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces that United would fix. I think right now they're looking for that one key piece that kind of stabilizes the situation. You know, they're not looking for that piece that puts them forward, obviously, because I think there's so many foundational pieces they still have to bring in. They're just looking for that guy that, you know, keeps them, God forbid, in the top half of the table, if not top six. But I think that's probably a little optimistic right now.
Yeah. So what is one player? I know you've mentioned Bruno Fernandes a couple times now, but what's one player that you would really target to try and fix this midfield structure?
In January, I think one guy, weirdly enough, realistically, we might be able to get would be a Christian Eriksen. Right now, at least on paper, it makes sense to me. He is a player that is proven. He's proven in this league. He would instantly solve our number 10 problem. He's a player that's great at distribution. He is willing to play out wide when the situation, you know, contends for it. And he could deliver a ball from anywhere. And right now, if Tottenham's going to be in the situation that they're in, because all of a sudden they're starting to flounder and you're starting to hear these reports that are sounding a little similar to like when Mourinho was going out, where all these players are sick and tired of the situation that they're in. And Eriksen, on top of that, has a contract situation coming up. Mm-hmm. He's a player that we could potentially could snipe. I think it would cost a lot of money, but you know, I think he's a player that fixes the short term, but also could have longevity in that position too. And he would be the one guy that we could get in January that would see us out for the next couple years, not just like gets us through the next maybe year and a half.
Yeah, I think something about the situation that helps in acquiring specifically Eriksen is that Tottenham are struggling, you know, similarly to Manchester United at this point. You know, it seems like Pochettino doesn't really want to be there, and it seems like a lot of their players don't really want to be there. But they're not in a position like Manchester United where if they really need to, they can whip out the checkbook that they don't like to use. You know, Daniel Levy is very stingy with his transfers for a reason. It's because Tottenham does not have enormous financial backing. So, you know, maybe it would cost a lot to get Christian Eriksen, especially to convince Daniel Levy to sell a player to a Premier League rival. But it seems like they're going to lose him for free anyway, so it's worth the try.
Yeah, and I think to a certain degree, Daniel Levy knows that $50 million for Eriksen obviously is increasingly better than zero, you know, in the summer. Granted, you don't want to have to face Eriksen twice a year, but I think it could be a win-win situation for both teams just because of the situation that Tottenham's in. They're all of a sudden starting to talk about a reboot, and if they were to bring in a significant chunk of change for a guy like Eriksen, who has stated now for a couple of years that he's really kind of feeling a move, you know, that's something that they could part ways with him. They brought two midfielders in over the summer in Lo Celso and Ndombele. So it's one of those situations where they could afford to lose Eriksen, not get killed on depth, and they can bring in the money that they need to bring in, you know, potentially a new goalkeeper. They got to probably fix their back line. It's starting to get a lot older really quickly. And so they've got some pieces that they need to fix as well. They're kind of giving me vibes of like that, you know, Manchester United second place finishing team under Mourinho, where yeah, that was, you know, they did really well, but you know, now they're another year older and they go into the next season instead of, you know, being ready to contend. They're all of a sudden need to be rebooted, and that was probably the best that they could do.
Yeah, and that Champions League finish for them was almost like a freak of nature thing happening. It's Lucas Moura breaking away for those three goals against Ajax was totally against the run of the fixture. So Ajax dominated both the first leg and the first half of the second leg in that one. And I think maybe it was partly the youth in the team that kind of fell apart for them against Tottenham. And I mean, against Manchester City too, that VAR dismissal of Raheem Sterling's goal. It's like two really, really lucky instances of a Tottenham team that was struggling mightily in the Premier League at that time to get them through both legs.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where they're kind of starting to they get too dependent sometimes on Harry Kane. And what was at least pretty impressive, I thought, last season was the real breakout of, you know, Heung-min Son, and Lucas Moura really stepped up in their attack. And it didn't seem like they were as reliant on Harry Kane, and they were starting to play really well. And then that's what bit them in the Champions League final, was they insist on starting Harry Kane after, you know, he had been out for 50 plus days and he looked rusty. And it was one of those things like maybe they should have just brought him in later on.
Yeah, and they changed their tactics as well to suit Son and Moura, but they didn't change it when Harry Kane came back in. So they were asking him to be this sort of high-press counter-attacking striker, and that is not his game at all.
No, absolutely not. It was a really weird marriage of ideas, and that's why Liverpool was able to get the win.
Yeah.
Because they were just confident in the way they played.
Yeah. So one of the targets I wanted to talk about a little bit was Paulo Dybala. And I know we tried, or we were heavily linked with him before the Premier League deadline in August. And it fell through reportedly over his insistence on not going to Manchester United. It seems as though Juventus are still shopping both him and Mandzukic. Do you think that it would maybe be a realistic transfer?
I think it'd be a great transfer. I don't know if it's realistic. Actually, I'll give a shout out to my guys from Richmond at the Total Soccer Show. They were talking about Serie A and how Paulo Dybala all of a sudden had that magnificent goal against Inter Milan. And they're like, you know, Sarri really scared Dybala into playing well by threatening him with going to Manchester United. And it was one of those, you know, the truth hurts, but it was also hilarious. But because Taylor Rockwell on the show is a Manchester United fan, and it was one of those ones where you probably could hear him over the mic cringe, but at the same time, I was like, yeah, it's probably true. I don't know. I think the situation would be a lot more realistic if we were top four, top six.
Yeah.
But I think as long as Dybala has that bargaining chip of image rights, you know, if he doesn't want to go to a team, he'll just mention it and be like, hey, sorry, guys, you can't afford me. And yeah. That'll kill any deal. Because right now, why would he leave? He doesn't need to leave Juventus. Juventus needs him to leave because they have to get some wages off of their bill.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's going to any team that isn't parallel to Juventus as far as talent and positioning in their leagues and money.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to rely on Paul Pogba to, you know, be a buddy and recruit him at this point. That, you know, we're not even sure if Pogba's going to stay past this season.
Yeah, well, I feel like we'd have half of the French national team on our team if, you know, Paul Pogba's recruiting was that useful, and God forbid we'd probably be challenging for first if we did that, but...
Yeah. Or if, you know, instead of recruiting Henrik Mkhitaryan, they use that money to go after the much-sought N'Golo Kante in the summer of 2016.
But we digress, Colin, we digress.
Right. I need to stop thinking about my career mode team.
Yeah, this is an Avengers Endgame. We just can't go fix things with the Infinity Stones, okay?
Right. So another target, and this will be the final one we talk about before moving on to the Liverpool game, who we've been linked with and who's been playing really well and is also from Leicester and would probably cost a Harry Maguire fee, is James Maddison. He seems like the kind of player in all aspects that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would want for this Manchester United team. He plays the number 10 role. He's pretty quick, and he's young, and he's English. But whether Leicester are willing to sell someone to Manchester United mid-season in a year where they could actually finish above Manchester United remains to be seen.
So this quote hasn't aged well, but to quote Rio Ferdinand, you put the paper in front of him and you say, sign it, put whatever amount you want on there, and you sign the paper. Because I think James Maddison is probably going to be one of the top attacking midfielders in England and in the world. He looks so good. His style of play, I think, is really fitting both for the way Ollie wants to play and kind of how a lot of managers want to play with this new, you know, attacking, you know, full on press. He's great with the ball. He can place it wherever he wants. He's not afraid to shoot it. You know, he has all these qualities, and he's still kind of a raw, unproven talent, and yet he looks so good already. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where I think under the right manager, he's going to become one of the best in the world. He's going to be definitely a fixture in the English national team for a long time. But once again, he's not a guy that you get in January because of those reasons that you said. Brendan Rodgers is not going to give him up when Brendan Rodgers has a real shot at finishing third in the league this year. Mm-hmm. I think he's a key cog in that team. He's doing a great job of, you know, service as far as providing, you know, Vardy the ball, getting the ball out to the wings. I think he's so key to what Brendan Rodgers wants to do in his own system that there's no way he'd give him up in January, certainly not to a club like Manchester United, especially when they still haven't even spent all their Harry Maguire money yet, so they're not even pressed for like, oh, we got to sell this player. James Maddison right now, if you try to buy him in January, I think he costs you as much as Paul Pogba. Which I don't think we would be likely to spend that much on one player when we have as many deficiencies as we do. I think he's more of a slow burn. We got to really kind of butter up Leicester over a summer. But we can start talking now because that's as long as it's going to take Ed to kind of start, you know, getting things going.
Maybe by the window but opens, yeah, he'll be at the point where he can, you know, be upset over a £5 million difference.
Exactly. But yeah, I don't see him being a January transfer. If Leicester all of a sudden just took a huge step back and they were looking more at, you know, 9th or 10th place, maybe, but not where they're at right now. They're challenging for a European spot right now. They're not going to give up one of probably their best player.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that Colleen Rooney hit on Leicester's morale.
I don't know. Jamie Vardy's kind of unflappable. I mean, we remember some of the things that he said, and then he went and won a title. You might remember, if you follow Brent Maximin, you certainly saw those tweets resurface too. So, Vardy is not worried about this. Yeah. Maybe his wife is, but Jamie's not.
Oh. So, transitioning into these, I guess, kind of long-term Manchester United goals to short-term. They're on the international break. When the players come back, the first match is against Liverpool, who have won every single game they've played so far. This, it's not an ideal match coming out of the international break for a lot of reasons, but it could maybe be a good point that if we can, you know, get a draw or somehow get a win, I mean, coming out of an international break could be good for players that are, you know, not in good form. And there's the possibility of Tony Martial coming back and Paul Pogba being healthy for this, and Wan-Bissaka, who's apparently been injured, coming back for this. Do you think that there's any chance we have at winning this game?
No.
Yeah.
Not even a little bit. Liverpool's looked less invincible in recent weeks. I mean, speaking of that Leicester team who should have drew with Liverpool over the weekend, but as constructed right now, the team that took the field against AZ Alkmaar and the team that took the field against Newcastle United, I struggle a little bit to imagine where they're able to mano a mano beat like LAFC. I think LAFC would give them a lot of problems. So against a team like Liverpool, I don't really see them having any kind of shot in hell of making anything happen. If Pogba's back, you know, maybe it's one of those things where we find a way to absorb like we did last year. Mm-hmm. And then Paul Pogba can pick that one pass out on a Hail Mary where we've got a Martial, we've got a Rashford, maybe a Greenwood just streaking down the field and is able to get the ball and then, you know, score a less proven goalkeeper since Allison's still out with it. They've got Adrian in there.
And they've looked vulnerable at the back, aside from Adrian even. I mean, Van Dijk has been making some mistakes leading to goals, and Red Bull Leipzig, who I know are a Champions League team and therefore a cut above us currently, but they put three goals past them and stole momentum from the match temporarily.
Right, but they also have a world-class striker in Erling Haaland, who I would really like us to sign. If you guys haven't read my newest article, check that out. I think for a derby, you throw that recent form out because I think Liverpool is going to be running at 100 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Klopp's going to be ready. He remembers how, let's not forget, Manchester United basically took the title away from Liverpool last year because they had that big lead over City. They drew with us. All of a sudden, they're dropping points, and City went on their run, and City was able to win by a point, mm-hmm. which is exactly what, you know, if they would have got 3 points against us, they would have probably won the league. So I think they're going to be really, really motivated, and United just – they don't have the personnel. At the end of the day, if Salah or Mane tire out or Firmino tires out, they're replacing those players with Origi, you know, Shaqiri. We don't have that kind of depth. Like we're throwing our best players out and we don't have anything even that's rated as a C plus or a B, you know, replacing one of our starters when it's time to make a substitution. So I think a positive result for United is, God forbid, they get a draw. But I think it's really more of just a mitigating the bleeding. I don't think we're looking for a win. I just think we're looking for not a bad loss, which is a sorry state for what we're doing right now.
Yeah. And, you know, after Liverpool, we've got Partizan away in the Europa League, Norwich away in the Premier League, which of the championship clubs to play away seems like the one we'd least want to. And then we've got the fourth round EFL Cup against Chelsea to close out October. Do you see us getting wins in any of those?
I think Partizan is going to be tough just because of the travel. Mm-hmm. I think that presents that's one of the challenges of playing in the Europa League is the fact that you're flying all across the continent.
I believe that's
for us Americans.
Serbia, I believe.
Yeah. So, I mean, for us Americans, we kind of just poo-poo at it because we're like, I mean, to go anywhere, you got to fly at least 3 hours, anywhere of note. But, you know, they make it a big deal about, oh, how we had to, you know, fly on a plane for like 6 hours. But if it bothers them, it's going to bother them. And that's what the Europa League does. Norwich, I think, is winnable. But the way they play, they could cause us a lot of problems because they're not afraid to press. Mm-hmm. And they have a guy like Pukki who will shoot. He'll shoot often, and chances are he'll get one in the back of the net. So Norwich is tough. But I think that's probably – Partizan or Norwich would probably be the most winnable. I think Chelsea's an L because they look a lot better right now. They're starting to click. And, oh, by the way, a month and a half ago, everybody shredded them on social media because Manchester United beat them 4-0. You think they're going to be thinking about that before that game because it's going to be a problem. Also, their defense is starting to come back. You know, Rudiger's getting healthy. That's a perfect storm of us just looking terrible against Chelsea.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to want to do another podcast collaboration with the boys from We Ain't Got No History.
Yeah, I think you have to, though. Just, I mean, it's like the Red Line Broadcasting. Yeah, you have to give them their W if you took a W.
Their one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe Brent won't join me on this one, though.
No.
So, after that, in November, Bournemouth, Brighton, Sheffield United. Games probably should win in the Premier League, but again, you know, games that we're supposed to win in the past month, we haven't been winning. Do you think, to kind of close this out, if we don't get going and we end up losing a lot of these games, you know, in a row, do you think that Ed Woodward pulls the trigger on firing Ollie?
I think he gets forced into it. Certainly losing to Bayern and Hove Albion would be a huge knock. I think the Sheffield the Sheffield United game. See, this is me working in USL.
You're about to get a lot of angry Yorkshiremen on you.
I know. I don't mean to mess that up, guys. I'm sorry. Omaha just announced their team in America. It looks exactly like the Sheffield Wednesday logo. It's just stuck in my head right now. But I think the game against Sheffield, that would be a turning point because they have been kind of up and down as well. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, they're the fifth or sixth loss in that stretch of, you know, 7-8 games, that at that point, I'm a huge Ollie supporter. I couldn't defend that. Yep. It would be very difficult to defend that. Especially with, you want to have a month to get a new manager in so that way he can make short-term plans for the January window. So I think that's kind of the cutoff point where it's like, show us, you know, what you can do before we hit December, because at that point we got to start preparing for Christmas.
Right.
So, because the last thing you want to do is kind of back into Christmas and then you have that logjam of fixtures and then you're going into the window rudderless, trying to find a manager. That would be a really, really bad situation. And that's a situation that, you know, teams that are going to be relegated find themselves in. And that's certainly a situation we don't want to find ourselves in.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we won't.
Well, no, we're not going to find ourselves in that situation because what we're going to do is we're going to do a smart thing and we're going to bring back Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He's going to come into that locker room. He's going to kick everybody's ass. And they're going to be like, you know what? We're going to finish this thing out right. Because he has a golden statue now.
Right. And he's about to have an MLS Cup under his belt, too.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think to go through the playoffs, they might actually have to play teams that are – their home field is turf, and Zlatan doesn't play on turf.
Yeah, so. Zlatan doesn't play on turf.
No.
Also, the Galaxy has no defense, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, they're pretty bad aside from Zlatan.
Yeah, but LAFC, watch, they'll be the new Red Bulls where they win the supporter shield, which in any other league would be enough.
Yeah.
But because this is a league with playoffs, you know, sorry about it.
Yeah. All right. So that's going to wrap it up for us. Nathan, thanks for coming on. You got any articles out you want to plug?
Yeah, I mean, my most recent feature, I talked about Scandinavian strikers, Erling Haaland, Zlatan Ibrahimovic. You know, how the combo, or if it one or two of those guys were to come in, they could potentially fix the Reds' attack. They certainly, present unique positives for the team if they were to come in. I'd certainly point you to that. My most recent article was not a feature. It was just three things we learned after that last Europa League game. Fourth thing that almost made the list that I learned was that there needs to be a refund option with Bleacher Report's pay-per-view games, because that was dissatisfying, to say the least. But those are the two most recent. I'm working on a feature right now for Brent, talking about potential seismic changes in the formation. We were curious about maybe looking at what a three-man back line might look like for Manchester United. So I've been doing some research on that, talking to consulting my book, The Mixer, you know, kind of seeing what was successful about Antonio Conte's three-man back line and if that's something that we can in any way replicate.
Yeah, and I think with Lindelof's athleticism and Tuanzebe's, you know, very clear athleticism and vision, that could be a pretty successful back line with maybe Maguire as the anchor.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. As far as the back line is concerned, I think that's one of the positives that we have. I think the real question mark in just my early research has been kind of who's going to be that linchpin holding midfielder, you know, because we don't have N'Golo Kanté as much as we wish we did. Yeah. Right now, we've got Nemanja Matić or Scott McTominay, which love me some Scott McTominay. I'm not besmirching him, but he's not N'Golo Kanté.
Well, no, there's only one N'Golo Kanté.
That's true. And when N'Golo Kanté smiles, we all smile.
Well, I'm going to pander to some of the old Man United fans and say, let's go 4-4-2.
Let's do it. Yeah, whatever puts Dan James in a position to beat Dan James and make me so proud of my son. I feel like such a proud dad whenever he scores, just because I wrote that stupid article in the beginning of the summer.
He scored those three goals and you were vindicated.
Oh, I was, as judged by my Twitter feed as I continuously reposted them.
God, that feels like a year ago.
It does, doesn't it?
I watched the highlights of that Chelsea game last night just to remind myself that we could score goals, and it just feels so long ago now.
Oh, it should be noted on YouTube TV the other day, it was like recommended at Manchester United, Newcastle. They were showing me the replay. I fell asleep during that game, so... Because I didn't get to watch it. I was at work. And so I was like, all right, I'm doing – Collins asked me to do the podcast. Let me, you know, actually sit down and watch this game. And my body is like, nah, you're not doing this to yourself.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can do it against Liverpool.
Maybe if we had the Longstaff brothers.
Right. Hey, there's some January targets for you. All right. Hey. Be sure to give Nathan a follow on Twitter. He is at @NathanEnio_. Is that correct?
No, so I decided to throw you off. I changed it up. So if you want to give me a follow on Twitter, it's @NathanIsRed. It works out because I'm a Manchester United fan, and that's also our hashtag for the Richmond Kickers. RVA is red. So it's a little double entendre for my two soccer teams.
Nice. Very nice. All right, Nathan, thanks for joining me.
Hey, stay on brand, everybody.